I think if we listen more to the poets and the musicians of the world, we might be in a better place than we are today, because let's be honest, right? We're kind of in a bad place.
Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. I'm Jack Corfield, filling in for Theo Finnegan to interview Dr. Paul D.B. Watkins, a professor of VIU's English program. On Friday, the 7th of March, from 10 to 11:30 a.m. at the Malaspina Theater, Paul will give a colloquium talk, which will combine sound, including a live DJ mix, images, material from the website, and text, adopting a self-reflective, creative approach, and cueing samples from interviews and the poets featured in his book. His presentation promises a captivating journey through the dynamic world of Black creativity in Canada. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hi, Jack. Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, tell us a little bit about what this book is.
For sure. Sounding Canaan takes its name from a code often used for Canada during the Black migration north. The book centers on the poetry of George Eliot Clarke, Dion Brand, Emner Bassey Phillip, Wade Compton, and rapper Kanon, and it explores how these poets draw from African-American and Afro-diasporic musical traditions, blues, jazz, reggae, and dub, hip-hop, and remix, to reshape ideas of identity and citizenship. So, in the book, I would say my approach is closest to the practice of DJing. I ask, what happens when you put a mixer and a crossfader between histories, cultures, and sounds? So one of the things that I think is pretty unique about the book is that it includes an accompanying soundtrack available on the website, and it argues that listening to these poets, really listening to the poems, the rhythms, the sampled sounds, is a form of sonic citizenship.
Could you expand on what you mean by sonic citizenship?
For sure. So the term sonic citizenship comes from a theorist named Vincent Andrisani, who explores the role of sound in Havana. He highlights the enduring presence of ice cream vendors whose sounds connect the cityscapes, despite shifting historical and political contexts. Similarly, I argue that listening to the poets and Sounding Canaan, that's, you know, really closely listening to the poems, the sounds, and the musical samples that they incorporate, also constitutes an act of sonic citizenship. So this immersive practice of reading, listening, and sounding engages with how citizens inhabit life in Canada. And it underscores the ways in which cultural identity and inclusion are negotiated beyond the formal legal structures of the nation state. So to put it another way, citizenship is sounded. It's more than a passport, just as multiculturalism is idealistically more than a policy. While a truly egalitarian multicultural Canada is largely a myth, particularly in the lived experiences of Black and Indigenous folk, I think at times it's a malleable myth with parts that are worth reworking, especially as countries like the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and even Canada as well, cry out often that multiculturalism is dead, right? Labeling it as a utter failure, and that there's a need to return to, whether it be traditional American, French, German, or English values.
Canada, just to the north, land of freedom, with the freedom seeker seeking something to believe in, hopelessly dreaming and praying, following the North Star, reaching for Canaan, only to find a new racism, smiling with deceit. History cries out, its pages stained to teach, but is Canaan something that's just always out of our reach? Listen, the Canaanites drum songs from a sonorous past into the ears of a disharmonious cast, seeking freedom at last. Because citizenship is something we collectively enact, so freely imagine what Canaan could sound like and be. Plant the seeds, remember. Nobody's free until everybody's free.
Freedom!
There's freedom in unity.
Freedom!
You performed this remix at your book launch. It was really a very engaging experience for the audience to see an academic, like, performance of something that's so very, very literary and, you know, something that would normally be quite dry to go to an academic reading of an academic book like this. But you managed to put so much life into it in this way. And could you tell me a bit about this clip and how you're approaching performing remixes of your book?
For sure. Given that the book employs a DJ methodology, right, so that's mixing poetry, theory, music, and other forms into my literary sonic mix, I wanted to try to emulate this approach in my reading performance, trumpeting the power of Black voice and song. So yeah, as you mentioned, right, in my experience, a scholarly book launch typically involves a short excerpt, it's followed by a book signing, but I really wanted to play with this format to remix it, just as I use remix as a theoretical apparatus in the book itself. So I only had a few weeks to put something together, but I wanted to, you know, see what I could do by resampling a lot of the music that the poets themselves are using. And I hope it serves as an effective way to sound out some of the key ideas of the book, right, mixed and mashed into around a 20-minute performance. So most of the tracks, as I mentioned, sample directly from the music that's discussed by the poets, a lot of the music that appears in the book itself. And for the colloquium, I will perform a similar version of what I did at my book launch.
I thought it was really interesting as I was reading through the book how you're able to combine all these different forms of artistic resistance through poetry and jazz, dub, reggae, hip-hop, and rap. It really creates so many opportunities to let different mediums speak to each other, which is very much what remixing is in this case, and how you play out that methodology, the DJ methodology, as this sort of multi-tool that really allows us as readers to see all these ways that we can look at remixing various different art forms together to say something in this very academic context. It's very artistic way of expressing something that's often quite rigid. And I wanted to know, could you tell us a little more about what you're hoping when you were writing this book, what you're hoping readers would take away?
Well, first and foremost, I hope the book gives readers an opportunity to either discover or deepen their understanding of the poets featured in its pages. I firmly believe that everyone should read poetry. I know that can be a hard sell at times. That said, some of the poetry in this book carries a certain immediacy, especially through its incorporation of music. At the same time, there's an inherent difficulty in some of the language and forms. I'm thinking of Amnar Bessie Phillips' fragmented style in Zong, Dion Brand's jazz-inflected epic ossuaries, or Wade Compton's turntable poetics. And yet, I think that difficulty is deeply rewarding to work through. I also hope readers come away with a greater understanding of Black Canadian history and literature more broadly. Historically, there's a substantive body of early Black Canadian writing, much of it on the fringes of the mainstream publishing industry. And, you know, this goes way back, often taking the form of pamphlets, leaflets, poems, religious tracts, public orations, and songs rather than novels. Whether or not they've had mainstream audiences, Black communities in Canada have had literary audiences, albeit not always, as I said, white ones, since their arrival. In Odyssey's Home, George Eliot Clarke refers to the existence of a canon of texts that dates back to 1785, highlighting a literary tradition that extends far beyond, you know, what I can actually even cover in the book. Even just looking at British Columbia, right, where we live, the history of Black immigrants here dates back to 1858, when many came from California. Initially, they settled in Victoria and Salt Spring Island, but as Vancouver emerged as the province's economic center, many relocated there, establishing homes in the east side's southern Strathcona district, a working-class neighborhood that would become known as Hogan's Alley. I first learned about much of this history through the poetry and activism of Wade Compton, the focus of Chapter 5. And in that chapter, I explore how Compton engages with historical resonances, mashups, and remixes Hogan's Alley, drawing from DJ culture and turntable poetics. Ultimately, I believe poetry has the power to model more inclusive understandings of citizenship, multiculturalism, and community. And I hope the book not only amplifies the voices of these incredible poets, but also helps readers develop the ability to really hear, feel, and love the music and poetry. I see it as a lifelong pursuit. Jack, given you've recently worked through the book, I'm wondering what the experience was like for you, especially since I don't think you were too familiar with any of the poets.
Yeah, I actually took a class with you, which had a lot of overlap in some of the topics that this book covered, but getting a chance to really like read through a much more specific and designed understanding of what that content is, and being able to have this job of working with you on this work op to find resources that connected with the book as you go through. It was really interesting to be looking at the content and the poetry, the music, especially doing the playlists was really fun. I got to like listen to these playlists over and over again as I'm making sure that they're all in the right order and putting them all back together. And even just reading the book, I would be listening through as I went and seeing how these like sonic relationships between the reader's experience experience of what they're reading and what they're hearing can really create this sort of, I'm not even sure what to call it. It's a more immersive experience, but it's also in being more immersive allows, at least for me, it allowed a lot of a connection with the material to try and like reach into it and try to understand it better.
That's good feedback. I'm glad it's resonating in that way.
Yeah, and hopefully now that there's all these extra resources, I guess it's interesting because adding these resources to the book like this, it's kind of my experience of like, oh, what was I thinking about? How can I find something that people can look at to see how it relates to the book? But I'm sure people will often go, oh, I just thought of something. Is it on the list? Oh, it's not there because I can't think of everything that could be connected, yes. Right?
So music and close listening to music, but also ideas, concepts, and poetry is a really big part of the book. The prelude opens discussing Marvin Gaye's What's Going On? While in prison, anti-apartheid revolutionary Nelson Mandela drew strength momentarily dissolving the prison walls while listening to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On? So it's a song that, you know, I think most people know. It's an anti-war, anti-poverty, anti-injustice, post-civil rights anthem. And Mandela drew a lot of power from the energy of the civil rights movement in the United States, and he related it to his own struggles in apartheid South Africa. So What's Going On, the album and the song, it calls on the listener to confront hatred, suffering, and injustice within the black struggle for liberation. You know, even just hearing some of those lyrics, it feels like it could have been written yesterday. Unfortunately, we see a lot of these things continue, unfortunately, to cycle back. So it's a wildly popular song, but some people just listen to the groove and the melody of the song without really hearing and feeling the words, right? So the idea is to try and attune to both, right? Both the beauty and the message.
Hi, my name's Theo and I teach in the English department at Vancouver Island University. You're listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM Nanaimo.
Definitely music and close listening are really central to how this book is experienced by the reader. Could you talk more about the role of music and listening in your work?
For sure. I dedicate space in each chapter to the discussion of black musical practices, right? So the book moves from analog to digital, as I was mentioning, right? From all the way from, you know, the spirituals and the blues to hip hop and remix, going through different traditions. And I try to make judicious links between certain genres and styles and a given poet's work. So each chapter opens with a listening that canons, right, that echoes and provides a sonic and generative entryway into a given author or body of text. And I like this approach since all the writers I explore at some point or another talk very explicitly about how music is central to their poetic craft. Indeed, many would welcome readings, I think, that move away from racial or gender codified analysis, right, that views Black Canadian writing solely as some kind of sociological service camp. So I'm not saying that I don't attune to the rhetorical aspects, to the social aspects, but it's not the only way, right? I'm not just looking at it in terms of rhetorical functionality, you know, how it teaches us to live, or solely under its aesthetic prowess as well, right? The mix and the remix remain central to my approach. And I think this ties in closely with the concept of listening or deep listening. So the pioneering musician and theorist Pauline Oliveros, she talks about deep listening, saying it's very close to what we call consciousness, right? Our ability to listen carefully and deeply can be trained, and technology is changing, for example, the very nature of the way that we listen, even perhaps how we approach a book, the fact that you can sort of listen to music in relation or in parallel as you're encountering the text. And I like this image because I think the DJ is this person who models this. So the DJ is the person who notices sounds, right, digging in the crates or the archives, and through remix opens spaces for previously unheard or dormant voices and sounds. And by extensioning, I think listening on the part of the critic, teacher, student is itself this kind of improvisational act that ventures towards that unknowable ledge, the space that Sun Ra called the other side of nowhere. So I try to model this kind of close listening. I show how the poets themselves are doing it, but I try to take that approach myself, right? So, you know, closely listening to four major poets, George Eliot Clarke, Dion Brand, Emmett Bessie Phillip, and Wade Compton, and one rapper, Kanon. For example, and I'll just take, you know, one sample from the book. So in the chapter on the work of Dion Brand, I open with a listening to John Coltrane's track Venus. It comes from his work Interstellar Space, one of his later recordings. And it's a really cosmological recording. Uses space as a theme that I think is, you know, more present perhaps than in any of his other work. And the only other musician on the recording is the drummer, Rashid Ali. And it comes off as almost folksy at times. It's, you know, it's a improvised recording, but it's really grounded in this folk sound. And on the recording, Coltrane alternates quiet moments with sections of great intensity. And so there's a dialogue, there's a conversation, it's dialogic, between Coltrane and Ali. And this is a recording that comes up in two of Dion Brand's works. So one of her long poems, Ossuaries, and her other work, The Blue Clerk. For example, in verso 14 of The Blue Clerk, Dion Brand provides a deep listening or a close reading of Venus, right? Talking about how the drums serve as pacing for the horn, that it has its own investment in the state of things. And here, the poet is venturing out to describe this in-the-moment conversation between Train and Ali, and is modeling for us, right, the listener, of how this dialogue takes place, draws our attention to a more open, lucid state of being, of really being present in the moment. So I think through Venus, Brand is inviting the reader to participate in a meaning that is ultimately irresolute, right? She's inviting us not to only listen, but to try to really hear and feel the revolutionary potential of Black music and creativity.
We spoke earlier, and I think I mentioned this in our intro here as well, that during this colloquium, you're going to do some of this remixing, using some of this DJ methodology in a very physical way by adding these like sound clips and such, similar to, I assume, what you did at the launch.
Yeah, as I mentioned, one of the distinctive aspects of my book is its DJ-inspired methodology. So I mix in close readings of poetry, music, cultural and literary history, and interviews with the poets whose work I analyze. In a way, this is a tactic to destabilize, you know, my own voice as an authority, and to create a larger, more expansive mix. For the colloquium presentation, I want to mimic this approach. So like the book launch, my presentation will feature remixes of key concepts and ideas from the book to get things going, followed by excerpts and analysis of work from the study poets. So the colloquium format gives me a little bit more time to play with form. So, you know, I'll open with the remixed readings, and then I'll get more into methodology and approach, and then some close reading as well to sort of model that listening practice for the audience. So the talk itself will blend sound, images, material from the website, and text and poetry.
The first thing most readers will probably notice as they're reading the book is that their pages include these connected songs that are attached to this playlist that each chapter has, and which are hosted on the Sound and Canon website. How do you imagine readers and listeners will engage with this intertextual relationship between book, website, and playlist?
Currently, I am on sabbatical and developing a complementary digital platform, Sound and Canon Remixed, a sonic compendium. And you know this, Jack, since you've been a great help in getting the website populated with material. For those listening, the website will host a comprehensive archive of materials from the book. It will feature audio and transcripts of interviews with the poets, as well as resources mentioned in the book, including newly added materials of interest. And users will also find playlists from the book available on both Spotify and YouTube, a section of remixed audio, and additional media and news. It's an easy one to remember. It's just soundingcanon.com is a good place to engage with the work on another level. So it's created for readers, listeners, potentially for particular courses, and research and discussion groups. So I'll spend some time during my talk showcasing this, which I'm hoping will be live pretty soon.
This is a bit more of a grandiose question, but why does it matter that we read into the relationships between poetry and history and experience? Like, how can poetry affect the present?
Good question. I mean, poetry exists and we're still in this present moment, but perhaps more people need to be reading poetry. As Dion Brand stated in her 2006 Gustafson lecture at Vancouver Island University, she said, "I thought then and still do that poetry is some kind of perfect speech, some way of getting at the core of things, some kind of honest submission to life." And went on to say that for her, this often meant tending to the wretched and brutalized consciousness of oppressed peoples. So poems have power, poems resist. Sometimes we have to really labor with them to convince ourselves or others that a work does something. And that something in Sounding Canaan is a poetics that I hope moves readers to really consider their own listening and to even take action to change the world, to make it better, to make it more loving, more just. Again, citizenship is sounded. I think if we listen more to the poets and the musicians, right, of the world, we might be in a better place than we are today, because let's be honest, right, we're kind of in a bad place. So poetry and music, it's a practice we should all make more time for, whether we are creating or listening.
I'm a big listener to a lot of different genres, but when I was listening through this book, I really found myself going back to the songs that connected to the content, to the experience here. And I found myself thinking back to, you mentioned Kid Koala a couple times in the book. He's a guy who's doing some really interesting stuff with live remix, right? And I remember finding a Kid Koala mix where he's working with a group, including Del the Funky Homo Sapien and Dan the Automator, for what's called Deltron 3030, which is just a little album. And it's the title track of the album, and it's really one of my favorite songs. I've been listening to it for many years now, and it just follows this like really long, epic kind of sci-fi-esque journey where the main like theory, the topic in conversation is this very like Afrofuturism kind of style of understanding like a millennia ahead version of what we're dealing with now. And what it shows in the song lyrics, and what is often showed in Afrofuturism as I've seen it, is that like these problems don't go away. This bad that we're talking about, that we feel in this present moment, is caused by systemic and historical issues that will continue to play out for that millennia ahead. And understanding how that while those things don't go away, there is still beauty and hope and creation that can come from working through that. We cultivated a
lost art of study, and I brought a buddy. I actually had the chance to see Deltron 3030
in
Toronto. They performed with a live orchestra, and it was just absolutely amazing. And of course, I've seen Kid Koala, who's the focus of the listening in Chapter 5 on Wade Compton, a number of times, and really just recommend, you know, if anybody ever gets a chance, you see Kid Koala coming to your city, go. You know, it's a, I think, a transformative experience to see him live.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite footnotes in the book, is when you mentioned the time you saw Kid Koala. Was it in a like a floaty chair?
Oh yeah, so I've seen him a number of times, but that one particular show was called Space Cadet, and yeah, you know, you were essentially in these little space pods on the ground, and you know, you had everybody in the audience had headphones, but yeah, just a really sort of beautiful experience where, you know, the music just washed over you.
Incredible. What about you? What kind of experiences do you find really connect to you? You know, you talked a lot in the book about a lot of different musics, but what are you listening to right now?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm always listening to music. I'm a big vinyl collector, so, you know, I've got about 2,000 pieces of vinyl, and in a way, you know, listened to music constantly while I was writing the book as well. For me, I've been listening lately to an album from Michelle Ende Gaocello, Grammy-winning album called No More Water, the Gospel of James Baldwin. Really fantastic album. Recently, I just reread James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, one of the, I think, the best essays, you know, ever written. The album channels Baldwin's words as well as his legacy. It's a powerful album, at times choral and collective in its sounding of love and hope, and at others singular in its focus of righteous anger. So I think, you know, both of those components are really important in sounding the present. I think everybody should listen to this album. Everybody should also go and read Baldwin if you haven't read any James Baldwin. Another one I've been listening to this week is from the legendary saxophonist Marshall Allen. It's his album called New Dawn. And Allen was an instrumental part of Sun Ra's orchestra and has continued that legacy. I've had a chance to see the Sun Ra Orchestra a few times under the stewardship of Marshall Allen. Now, the wild part is this album is his debut solo album, and he released it at the young age of 100. So, you know, it's never too late to record that album, write that poem, or do the thing you've been wanting to do that you've been putting off. It's quite inspiring, and I have to think that the cosmic music he plays helps keep him young. And hopefully that's just another endorsement, you know, to read the poetry. And if you're wanting to hear more, come to Michael Oakleum Talk.
Looking forward to being there. Thanks, Paul. That's all we have for today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Paul Watkins for joining me today. For more information and to hear other episodes of our show, please visit conversationspodcast.ca. Technical production by Robin Davies. Our music is by Greg Bush. Additional audio production on this episode was done by me, Jack Corfield. Thanks for listening.